Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What is the relationship between money and bliss? We've all heard that we can't buy happiness, and yet it is hard to shake the suspicion that greater financial resources might indeed make us more content. Well, now there is scientific evidence that money does play a role in how we feel about our lives, but the way it leads to or detracts from satisfaction are pretty surprising. Elizabeth Dunn is Associate Professor of Psychology at the University of British Columbia. Her new book, written with co-author Michael Norton, is called Happy Money: The Science of Smarter Spending. Elizabeth, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having me.
Well, first and foremost, why do we believe that money will make us happy?
Well, for one thing, we like things that we can count. Huh. Money is really easy to count. It provides a really nice, easy way to compare ourselves to other people. And so I think we're quite attracted to that simple kind of comparison. Also, it does play a really fundamental role in our lives.
Hmm. Well, I want to make it clear off the top that you're not offering financial advice per se. This is not a book on how to retire happy or whatever. But it does seem pretty clear throughout that drowning in debt is definitely not a path to happiness.
No, in fact, debt is probably one of the worst things for happiness. There's almost nothing that people could do with their money to improve their happiness more than paying off debt.
Hmm. So if ample money in and of itself does not lead to extraordinary happiness, what is the story for people who literally don't have enough to get by? There is an effect there.
Right. So money does matter for happiness, particularly when people are struggling to meet their own basic needs. So, you know, if you're having trouble putting food on the table, getting an extra $10,000 a year is going to make a difference for your happiness. But what's sort of surprising is that people will tend to keep chasing that extra $10,000 long after there's plenty of food on the table, long after their basic needs are met.
So there's endless advice out there about how to earn more money. What made you decide to look at better ways for using what money we already have?
Well, I was curious because I found myself suddenly in my mid-20s with my first real job, my first real salary, and I wondered, you know, what could the happiness research tell me about how to use that money to be happier?
So we don't necessarily feel happier when we can buy anything we want.
Well, right. Surprisingly, once people in the United States are making around $75,000 a year, additional income has essentially no bearing whatsoever on people's day-to-day positive feelings.
Hmm. And yet we all keep, you know, there are people earning 10 times that are striving to get that extra bonus next year. What makes us keep trying to earn money even after we have as much as we need?
You know, I think it's sort of the same as the puzzle about why do we keep eating ice cream after we've already filled up on it, right? So,
right.
You know, that first bite tastes so great that you kind of keep going, even though the sort of added benefit of having more may be quite limited. I think we tend to focus on how good that first raise felt or how good that first bite tasted, and that can help drive our behavior to try and get more and more.
So lots of people have probably experienced the very temporary rush that can come with buying something that we have wanted. But then most people recognize that it doesn't last over time. That feeling goes away. Why do we keep doing it? Why do we keep going out and buying things we don't necessarily really need when we've been disappointed time after time in their ability to deliver long-term happiness?
Well, what's fascinating is that most people possess that knowledge that the pleasure of a new toy fades. And yet, research shows that people tend not to apply that knowledge when faced with a new purchase. So we go, oh, yeah, you know, that new car didn't make me happy for as long as I thought it would, but this flat-screen TV is going to do the trick.
Hmm. So it's like, yeah, none of that counts. Now, this is, I should have bought this in the first place because this is the thing.
Exactly. Even with something as simple as a kaleidoscope, research shows that people think, oh, yeah, I'm going to enjoy this just as much next week as I'm enjoying it today, even though they know when their attention is called to the passage of time, they recognize that the pleasure of a new purchase fades. They just don't think of that spontaneously when contemplating a new purchase.
So you recommend that we buy experiences instead of stuff when they're, you know, after everything else is, after basic expenses are taken care of. Why do vacations and event tickets and nights out with friends make us happier than cars and clothes and houses?
Well, partly because experiences tend to be shared with other people. They tend to bring us closer to others. So, for example, if you go out for a nice dinner, you're likely to go out to that nice dinner with some friends or maybe family members. You're likely to share in this positive experience with people that you care about. In contrast, a new pair of shoes is likely to be enjoyed, you know, in a relatively solitary fashion, as much as we might like to think that those around us are celebrating our beautiful new, you know, high heels. It's probably not the case. Other people probably don't care, and we're just going to be essentially walking alone in our own shoes, whereas when we buy experiences, we're tending to really commune in a positive way with other people.
And, of course, they give us those experiences give us something to talk about later, whereas, you know, there's only so many times I can ask my friends to admire my beautiful new shoes.
Exactly. Experiences make better stories than even the nicest pair of shoes. And it turns out people are actually liked better when they discuss their experiential purchases, things like vacations and meals, than when they discuss material purchases.
And even I've had this experience, even if a vacation is in fact less than perfect, our brains sort of reframe them so we accentuate the positive.
Exactly. I mean, that's part of the magic of the human mind, is that we're able to look back on the experience and, you know, even the parts that weren't very positive, we can sort of see the funny side of them. And what we're likely to call to mind are those, you know, really wonderful peak experiences that we had as part of, say, a vacation.
And then with a vacation, there is the looking forward, there is the experience, and then for the rest of our lives, we can remember it.
Exactly. And people see their experiential purchases as being much more closely connected to their true sense of self compared to their material purchases.
So there are, of course, a couple different ways to finance a vacation, one of which is saving up and then going. The other is putting it all on the credit card. Assuming we pay about the same amount of money, why is it so much better to pay ahead rather than pay after?
Well, it hurts to pay, no matter when we do it.
Right.
But the good thing about paying up front is that it enables you to then later enjoy the experience as though it were free. So even if a vacation costs exactly the same amount, whether you pay for it, you know, 3 months in advance or right after you get back from the vacation, it feels like it costs you much less when you're on that vacation if you've already paid for it in the distant past. Research shows that people begin to see something they've paid for long ago, begin to treat it as though it were free.
So then there's no stress of, you know, ordering that extra glass of wine or whatever because you feel like it's not going to affect your budget once you get home again.
Right. You don't sort of feel the, you know, thinning of your bank account with every sip of wine that you take, every taxi ride and so forth. You know, if you've paid for as much of the vacation as you can up front, it really frees you to enjoy that vacation during the experience.
Okay, so let's assume, Elizabeth, that we're in a place in our lives where we can afford to have whatever small indulgence we like, whether it's getting, you know, nails done or eating M&Ms every day or drinking expensive coffee. We can afford to do that pretty often. Why is it better not to do it pretty often?
Well, the irony of happiness is that we feel like having our favorite things all of the time would provide us tons and tons of joy. And yet, it turns out that abundance is actually kind of the enemy for happiness. When we have something that we like all the time, when we have unfettered access to our favorite things, we tend to take those things for granted. And that's not just something like your mom said. Research shows that people cease to derive the same levels of pleasure from something when they have it all the time.
And so I guess that comes back to the idea that, you know, overspending on where you live or what you drive doesn't really pay dividends in terms of how you feel about your life.
Exactly. So I think one of the most surprising findings in the research that we did is that owning a home or moving to a newer, nicer home seems to have little to no bearing on people's happiness. And part of the problem is that our homes, for the most part, stay the same. So, you know, for example, when I moved into my current home, we tore out the ugly pink carpet and put in these beautiful maple hardwood floors. And when we first tore out the carpet and put in the floors, I thought, wow, we have this beautiful, amazing house. And every time I walked in, I thought, gosh, what gorgeous floors. I can promise you that in the past month, I have never walked into my house and thought, what wonderful floors. I've just walked over them to where I'm going.
Hmm. I guess you did eliminate the unhappiness. I mean, did the pink carpet make you unhappy every time you walked on it?
Oh, well, the pink carpet was simply unlivable. So it was pretty, but I think it had been there since about 1986. And so it had to go. But I think the sort of unfortunate part is that my husband and I spent, you know, every Saturday in hardwood showrooms, comparing, you know, maple to red oak to bamboo. All of these were way better than the carpet. The carpet had to go. But it didn't really matter whether we had bamboo or oak or maple. You know, these fine-grained distinctions between various products end up having less of an impact on our happiness than most of us tend to assume.
So before the big recession hit, certainly this was the case. People would talk about drive till you qualify. And it doesn't matter how far out you have to get from wherever it is you work or go to school or spend most of your time. If you want a certain kind of house, you just move far away and then take the car in. But it turns out that a lot of us really hate commuting.
Exactly. I mean, commuting is really one of the worst things for people's happiness. Having a long commute has such a detrimental effect on happiness that it's almost equivalent to being unemployed, which, of course, is terrible for happiness. So I think it's actually the worst possible advice that we could take is to, you know, drive however far you have to in order to have that big home. In fact, big homes have little bearing on our happiness. So having a bigger home but having to commute for it is just a terrible trade-off for happiness.
Hmm. And so there's all that time that ends up being wasted if you have to travel farther than you'd like on a regular basis. But thinking about time as money turns out to be a major drain on happiness.
Yeah, so it's really fascinating. You know, we have this tendency to see time as money. Even, you know, Benjamin Franklin advocated the idea that time is money. And yet, monetizing our time, seeing, you know, every minute as a potential dollar, can actually get in the way of our ability to engage in really happy activities like volunteering. If I see every hour of my time as being worth, you know, $100, I'm not going to want to just go give that time away by volunteering. I might not even want to take the time to exercise or recycle. And yet, resisting the engaging in these behaviors, we're actually depriving ourselves of happiness.
So what do you recommend to people who are in jobs that sort of do work that way, that they don't get paid unless they show up, or they're working for commissions? Are there ways to kind of reset the way you think about money, even if your job does mean exercising takes money out of your pocket?
It's certainly an uphill battle. I mean, we know that being paid, for example, by the hour, has a powerful effect on the way that people think about time. And in fact, even if you stop working by the hour, it takes about 2 years for the effect of having worked by the hour to wear off on the extent to which you see time as money. But that said, you know, there's certainly ways we can reframe other decisions in our lives. So, for example, you know, when we contemplate a purchase, I think one of the best things we can possibly do is just pause to ask ourselves, how will this purchase change the way we use our time? Hmm. And in asking ourselves that question, we kind of teach ourselves to really make time the ultimate goal, to prioritize time rather than money.
My guest is Elizabeth Dunn. She's an associate professor of psychology at the University of British Columbia and co-author, along with Michael Norton, of the new book Happy Money, The Science of Smarter Spending. We're opening the phones now to take your questions and comments. The telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. You can learn more at smu.edu/mls.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Elizabeth Dunn, Associate Professor of Psychology at the University of British Columbia. Her new book is called Happy Money, The Science of Smarter Spending. If you'd like to ask a question or maybe share a story about your philosophy on money and happiness, give us a call. The number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. So in talking about the relationship between time and money and happiness, Elizabeth, will I gain happiness if I pay somebody else to do a chore that I don't like, say, scrubbing the floors in my house or mowing the lawn or cleaning the gutters?
I think that is a great use of money. My husband marvels at the astounding amount of time it takes me to clean our kitchen, and even though our kitchen is tiny. And so for me, paying somebody to clean our house regularly, I think, is one of the best uses of money. And indeed, you know, what really matters for our happiness is the way we spend the, you know, minutes and days of our lives. And so changing the way we spend our time on that kind of day-to-day basis can make a real difference for our happiness.
To what extent is our satisfaction or dissatisfaction with our own finances a factor of how we think that our friends and neighbors are doing?
Certainly, comparisons matter. So the same amount of money means something very different depending on whether you're surrounded by people who are making more of it or less of it than you are. And, you know, even given the same exact amount of money, people tend to be happier when they're surrounded by other people who are making less than them.
And what have you learned from the fact that no matter what people earn, they always are sort of looking for a little more? You know, like you think about, like, Bill Gates has now sort of changed his life, but there was a point at which, you know, 15 years ago that you think, how much more money can you make, Bill Gates?
Yeah, I mean, that's the really interesting feature of money, is that it matters so much when we have so little of it, but we continue to try to get more of it even when we already have plenty.
So the other reason that I wanted to bring up Bill Gates is, of course, he has now made a huge focus of giving money away. And this turns out to be something that counterintuitively makes us really happy.
Yeah, and this is really a question that has been central to my own research. For example, in one study, we sent people out on the campus of the University of British Columbia armed with some extra cash. We basically walked up to them and handed them a $5 or a $20 bill, told some of them to spend it on themselves, and we told some of them to spend it on somebody else. And when we called them back at the end of the day, we found out that people who spent the money on others, whether they, you know, donated it to charity or bought a coffee for a friend or whatever, people who spent money on others were happier.
So I suppose there's the social effect of feeling like you've done something good, and then is it about seeing someone else enjoy that money?
Yeah, that seems to make a really big difference. So knowing that you've made a positive impact on somebody else seems to provide a real boost for our own happiness.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak with Terry in Rockwall. Hi, Terry.
Hello.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
You know, one of the things that is always hard for me to decide is, am I better off making more money and hiring somebody to do the yard, or, and then I'm forcing myself into a, you know, a higher tax bracket and having to pay more and kind of painting myself into a circle there, or staying in a lower tax bracket and just manually doing some of those things that I can do myself. It's like you say, trying to say, you know, what am I worth? Am I worth, you know, $45 an hour? What am I worth? You know, is it worth it to do the yard? That's always a place I always have a very hard time trying to make up my mind, which direction should I be going with that.
Any thoughts, Elizabeth?
Yeah, no, I think that's a fantastic question. It's such a central issue that so many of us face. And, you know, one thing I would say is that it's best to reframe that decision. And rather than thinking about, okay, how much is my time worth and I should pay somebody for, you know, any task, if my time is worth $45 an hour and I can get someone to, you know, clean my yard for $20 an hour, then automatically I should hire them. Instead, the way I would ask the question is, okay, how do I feel when I'm cleaning my yard? You know, is this something that makes me feel like I'm getting something done? It provides me with some exercise and some energy. If so, go ahead and do it yourself and, you know, spend a little less time at the office. On the other hand, if cleaning your yard is an activity that you dread, that makes you miserable just thinking about it, then, you know, go ahead and hire that other person. You'd probably be happier working a little more and spending a little less time on yard maintenance.
We have an email here from Richard who says, if there's something I really want to buy and delay doing so for years but keep fretting about wanting, would I have been happier buying the item right away so as to get the purchase out of my system? Richard says, I've been doing this about a sports car for more than 20 years. Each time it's been time to buy a car, I've done the practical thing instead.
Well, I think sports cars often work best in our imagination. It turns out that people who drive more expensive cars think that they'll enjoy them more, but in fact, if you look at people's actual experiences while driving their cars, those with nicer, fancier, more expensive cars report no more enjoyment while driving compared to people with more basic cars. So probably by putting off that purchase, you're not cheating yourself of that much happiness, and you're kind of getting that enjoyable fantasy process that occurs when there's something pleasurable that, you know, maybe we'll get that someday, maybe when you're 60 you'll get it. That provides kind of a source of anticipation and pleasure, and in fact, imagining a pleasurable experience can sometimes be better than actually having it.
Yeah, my sisters think I'm crazy, but if they give me a gift card for my birthday, I will hang on to it for months just thinking about all the stuff I can get.
Right. It's just fun to imagine the things that we could do sometimes, and sometimes that sort of fantasizing provides more pleasure than the actual purchase itself.
In terms of the fancy car thing, do you think that's because when you're actually driving the car, a Jaguar gets caught in the same traffic as a Hyundai?
Exactly. And it's those, you know, little local features of being trapped behind, you know, an elderly woman driving very slowly while you're rushing to pick up the kids at daycare. It's those sorts of minute, seemingly trivial daily experiences that tend to shape our moods much more so than, you know, whether our car has, the super high grade features that we might fantasize about when we're thinking about buying a car.
We have an email here from Philip who writes in the subject heading Depression Baby. Philip says, how can somebody raised not to spend money learn to spend more and enjoy it? I'm guessing that there's no more context than that, but I'm guessing maybe Philip has plenty of money saved, but feels uncomfortable spending any of it.
Well, sometimes it helps if we sort of put money aside for a specific purpose. So one thing that I do, and this is kind of based on some research, is I'll put money into a travel account, and I've earmarked that bank account just for travel, and I put the money in there. So then when I buy, you know, pay for a trip, say, I feel like I've already, you know, set that money aside. So in a way, it feels kind of free because that's what the money is there for. And we don't feel quite the same pang of paying when the money's been set aside for a specific purpose, as opposed to when we just kind of tap into our overall main bank account.
Do you think the way that products and services and credit are marketed to us actually have, although they promise instant happiness, have gotten in the way of our happiness?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, certainly the incredible rise of the credit card has created real problems for people's happiness by encouraging us to, you know, consume right away and pay for it much later, which actually undermines our happiness.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Bernard in Dallas. Hi, Bernard.
How you doing?
Great, thank you.
I was listening to the show, and I was thinking about a friend of mine. Her name is Patricia Falvey, and she came to the United States at the age of 20, $200, and then rose to become one of the top two or three people in her field of public accounting in the country. Then about 5 years ago, without having any contact in publishing or having taken a college writing course, she just quit her accounting job, became a writer, had the number one novel in Dallas and the number one Kindle in the world. And
wow.
I thought it was very much like J.K. Rowling. And before, you know, right after she quit her accounting job, people would call her and say, I can't believe you quit that job. I mean, you have no background in writing, but she just decided that she wanted to write about her family's history in Northern Ireland.
Is she happier, Bernard, as a writer than as an accountant?
Yes.
What do you think about that, Elizabeth?
Well, I think often, you know, taking that brave leap and deciding that you're okay making a little bit less money, or sometimes a lot less money, in order to be able to do what you love is actually a really good decision for happiness.
And it is one, you know, as Bernard was mentioning, you know, people around you may not understand that choice.
Absolutely. I mean, it's really easy to justify to the people around you that you've taken a new job that's going to pay you $30,000 more a year. It's a lot harder to explain when you've just taken a job that's going to pay you $30,000 less. But the fact of the matter is that, you know, once you're making a comfortable income, that $30,000 one way or the other is going to make some difference, but not a huge difference for your day-to-day happiness. So if that trade-off enables you to go from doing something you hate to doing something you love, probably a pretty good decision from a happiness perspective.
So if giving away a little bit of money, $5 or $20, makes you pretty happy, does, you know, giving a lot away make you happier? Or is it sort of the same diminishing returns as making over a certain amount of money that keeps your family comfortable?
It's a really fascinating question, and we're still trying to figure out the answer to that question. You know, one thing that we see in our research is that the amount that you give away is less critical than the extent to which you can see that you're making a difference. So sometimes, you know, say helping out a friend or a neighbor with even a very small sum of money can make a real difference for that other person. And in those instances, we're likely to feel a lot of gratification and happiness, even if the amount of money for us, you know, was fairly trivial.
I was interested that this study was, or a similar experiment has been done in multiple different countries, including places where the average citizen is pretty poor, living pretty much hand to mouth.
Mm-hmm, exactly. In our initial research, we studied the idea that spending money on others would promote happiness in Canada and in the United States, relatively wealthy countries. It was actually in interviews like this one where we were asked, okay, you know, fair enough, people feel good when they spend their money if they've got plenty of it, but what happens if, you know, you go to a poor country? Would you see the same effects? And so what we did was to go to poor countries, and we took our research to places like Uganda and Africa, where many people are really struggling to meet their own basic needs. And actually, much to our surprise, we saw that we were able to find exactly the same effects, where people felt better when they used their money to benefit other people, even when they themselves were struggling to meet their own basic needs.
The one question I have about this study is that you gave your study subjects the cash. So there was like no cost to them. Did you have to factor that into whatever correlation you might be able to make with a similar action in real life where the $20 actually comes out of my wallet?
That's a great point, right? So if a researcher has given you the money, it's not quite the same as spending your own money. For that reason, we also conduct studies in which we ask people to look back and really reflect on a time when they spent their own money on other people or on themselves. And even when we ask people to think about a time they spent their own hard-earned cash on somebody else, we see the same effect whereby people feel better when they think about a time where they spent money on others rather than themselves. So it seems to be the case that people get this warm glow of giving, whether they're, you know, giving away money that we provided them with or whether they're giving away their own hard-earned funds.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Paul in Plano. Hi, Paul.
Hi. Yes. I was reading the Popcorn Report a while back, and she was talking about cocooning, and she was talking about doing things like people would go and, rather than buy a fancy sports car, I would go out and buy a really, really nice ink pen so that that I could enjoy that ink pen instead of that sports car, maybe rather than going to the Greek Isles, going to a day spa, a really great day spa. Mm-hmm. And that seemed to be a satisfying kind of alternate pleasure. What about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think surprisingly small sources of pleasure can sometimes provide a lot of happiness, particularly if it's something that we are going to really look forward to. So obviously you're going to look forward to a trip to the Greek Isles, but if you plan that day spa experience for a few weeks from now and you're going to go with a whole bunch of friends and you're all talking about it and picking out what treatments you're going to have and so forth, I think that can provide a lot of the same sorts of benefits that we would get from a much larger expenditure. I think one thing that we see is that the amount of money that you spend is not necessarily the best predictor of your happiness. What matters is the kind of expenditure that you're making, say buying an experience rather than a material thing.
So if we quickly level off, if our enjoyment quickly levels off after we put in those great new hardwood floors or buy a new house or a car or something, and then we adjust, does it work the same way so that if by circumstance or by choice we are forced to live on much less, assuming once again that basic needs are met, are we able to be happy despite not being able to picture it at our current income level?
Right. I mean, so the tendency for humans to kind of get used to whatever they've got and be reasonably content with it is, you know, kind of a bummer when you're making lots of money and buying wonderful things and you get used to them. But it's a very useful tendency if, you know, things aren't going perfectly and you have to live, you know, in a house that isn't ideal and you have to get by without some of the things that you'd like to have. The good news is we get used to whatever situation we've got and we're likely to kind of return to our baseline level of happiness pretty quickly.
I don't know if you have children, but have you given any thought to what this indicates about the way that we should talk to young people about money?
Well, I actually do have a 10-month-old baby, so that those conversations about money are still a little far in the future. Certainly I think there's a lot of room to educate children to think more carefully. You know, I think kids get very focused on, you know, earning allowances and so forth, but I think it's rare to see parents have conversations with kids about how do you want to spend your money? If you think, you know, kids, we get focused on thinking about how much is your allowance going to be and so forth, but what should you do with that allowance? What use of your allowance will make you happiest? And even try like a little experiment with your kids where you say, okay, this week with your allowance, why don't you try using it to help somebody else, you know, and see if that makes you happier. And I think those kinds of spending experiences as a child could be really beneficial for helping provide some guidance when people are faced with making much larger sums of money as adults.
Elizabeth Dunn is my guest. She's Associate Professor of Psychology at the University of British Columbia and co-author, along with Michael Norton of Harvard, of the new book Happy Money, The Science of Smarter Spending. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Elizabeth Dunn is Associate Professor of Psychology at the University of British Columbia and co-author of the new book Happy Money, The Science of Smarter Spending. She's also our guest for this hour. And if you'd like to join the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. I want to talk about the happiness of having money put away. We have an email here from Steve who says, I was never as happy, safe, comfortable, and content as when I was able to put away a cushion of savings and also realize the world would not end if I became unemployed, that I would survive.
Yeah, savings make a real difference for happiness. So there's actually some really interesting research showing that happiness is kind of encoded in our genes. So there's a real genetic influence on happiness. But interestingly, that genetic factor is stronger among wealthier individuals. And researchers think that this is because when you have more money or you just have some more savings tucked away, you can kind of live up to the happiness levels that are encoded in your genes. Whereas if you don't have any money to fall back on, you're more susceptible to kind of the slings and arrows of daily life, and your happiness can kind of bounce all over the place. You're sort of more like a pinball, vulnerable to all the things that life throws at you, whereas savings kind of provide a buffer that keep you up at that happiness level that, you know, help you deal with, say, a major illness or a car accident or the other unexpected events that, life tends to throw at us.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Steve in Richardson. Hi, Steve.
Hello.
Hi. Are you there? Okay, we will move on instead to Gabby in Dallas. Hi, Gabby.
Hi, Chris. I had a question about how to deal with the insecurity of making a decision to either leave my job to a lower paying job in order to take care of my children. How do you deal with that insecurity? I just feel like that artist was able to, or that accountant was able to leave her high paying job. She probably saved a lot of money. And then she was able to transition after 20 years into a writing position that she probably developed along the way. But she still dealt with insecurity. So my question is, insecurity is going to be the same. It's just how you deal with it. So how would somebody like that accountant or myself could deal with that insecurity?
Are you talking, Gabby, about emotional insecurity?
Insecurity, period. Whether it be emotional, whether it be financial, because it's all kind of wrapped up into the same thing. You don't want to go. You don't want to do it. But that somehow that accountant was able to find it in herself to see the dots, and she took the risk.
Any thoughts, Elizabeth?
Well, I think realistically looking at the situation and, you know, examining, can you afford to cut back, right? Are there places in your life where you're spending a lot of money that you could probably, you know, get by with less and make it so that, you know, that life transition, whether it's to becoming a writer or a stay-at-home mom, you know, can you make that transition and sort of not be racked by insecurity? You know, it turns out that what matters more for people's happiness is not the objective amount of money that they have, but rather kind of the way they feel about it. And having like a looming sense of financial insecurity is really bad for happiness. So, you know, I think you wouldn't want to cut back on, say, you know, your current job until you can kind of take a good, hard, realistic look at your life and your finances and say, okay, I'm going to cut back in these areas. You know, I'm going to sell the car and take the bus, and that's okay. You know, that you can get by with less. You want to make sure that you can do that first. You know, maybe try living on that sort of lower budget and saving all of the additional money that you have, giving yourself that extra buffer, you know, and trying it out, because if you are worried all the time about money, that is going to bring down your happiness in a way that, you know, will, I think, detract from the joy of writing or the joy of parenting.
I'm not exactly sure how to ask this question without sounding judgmental, which I really don't mean to be, but based on this research and on what you've learned about money and happiness, is there something psychologically wrong with people who are really obsessed with the acquisition of money and with making it clear that they have wealth and are spending it conspicuously?
I don't think there's something wrong with them in that, you know, they're sort of being like good members of our culture. Our culture just bombards people with these messages that material acquisition is important. So if you live in this culture and you accept that message, I mean, you're just kind of being a good American. You know, it's not that there's something pathological wrong with you. At the same time, there is a whole lot of research showing that it's hard to be one of those people, that being somebody who really values material acquisitions, really values money over all other things, puts you at risk for a lot of unhappiness.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Tammy on the line in Fort Worth. Hi, Tammy.
Hi, Chris. I have, for a long time now, internalized deeply the idea that my life, by choice, is trying to, I guess, accumulate high quality of experiences versus a large quantity of possessions. But when I was in Nepal for 3 months back in 99, I found myself really obsessing with trying to buy up a lot of souvenirs and, I guess, cultural objects, because I felt this intense need to try to recreate my experience in that country for people back here. And so I've really kind of, I don't know, relapsed or felt this materialistic obsession to just buy things to try to bring the country back with me in a duffel bag, perhaps. And so I wonder if your guest can speak to that, if she's had done any research on tourism and people who travel to other countries for work or pleasure.
Thanks so much for your call, Tammy. What an interesting observation.
Yeah, no, that's fascinating. I mean, I think souvenirs are a really interesting category because they sort of blur the line between material purchases and experiential purchases. They're sort of the material purchase that we take away from our experiential purchase. And I think that they can be a nice source of happiness when they give us a chance to reflect on that really positive experience in our lives and maybe, you know, that sort of little treasure from Nepal sitting on our desk at work prompts other people to ask us about that experience and gives us an opportunity to kind of relive it. So I think, you know, having some souvenirs can be beneficial. Now, when our, you know, home becomes overrun with, like, for example, my husband has these incredibly ugly pillows from Thailand that, like, he refuses to get rid of. And it's becoming a minor source of marital conflict. Then, you know, then I think maybe, okay, it's a little too much. Can you kind of narrow it down to your one favorite thing from each place that you've been? And again, it goes back to this idea that having more of something we like tends not to provide us with more happiness. So having a little thing, one little treasure from that favorite place that we visited could be a meaningful source of happiness. The mistake that we make is when we keep collecting and collecting and collecting and thinking that each additional treasure will provide the same kind of additional boost in happiness.
Is there a predictable pattern of the ways that we spend money as we age? Because similar to your experience when you got out of school, I certainly could buy more for myself today than I could at 21 when I had my first job, but I don't want to.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that's a really interesting topic is like how do our ideas about money change across the lifespan? And it's something that we're really only beginning to examine. One thing that's kind of surprising, though, is that the way people spend their money seems to have fairly similar consequences across the lifespan. So, you might think that older adults would benefit more from living in a nice house than, say, younger adults who might be perfectly happy in sort of a crash pad of other 20-somethings. In fact, though, some research with retired adults suggests that even, older adults don't show much of a benefit from devoting more of their income to housing, and even they benefit more from leisure spending, from spending money on experiences.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have April on the line in Austin. Hi, April.
Hi.
Hi, go right ahead.
I wanted to ask about the spending on experiences. You mentioned perhaps spending money on a trip to a day spa and that the return on that investment would be higher if spent with other people and where you can anticipate it with friends and look forward to it and talk about it with friends. I am deeply introverted. I would prefer to have experiences all by myself because I'm not shy. I love people, but I'm recharged and refreshed when I am alone. Does that diminish the spending that I do on those experiences?
Well, what's fascinating, I mean, I totally resonate with your intuition about that. There's actually research where introverts are instructed to act like extroverts, to, you know, be more social and so forth. And they actually show just the same kind of happiness boost, at least in the short term, that extroverts do from behaving, you know, from engaging with others. Now, that said, if what you're really looking to do is recharge and just, you know, be able to take that breather from daily life, and that's what you really need, then, of course, you know, you have to think about your own proclivities and preferences. And certainly, you know, I can see having a facial all by yourself being a perfectly positive experience.
So this is not really the subject of the book, but I'm curious, you know, people talk about couples in relationships and money tends to be such an issue when couples have different priorities. Are there suggestions that you have based on your research for people who are making decisions about money with someone they love very much, but who has different ideas about the best way to glean happiness from that spending?
Yeah, it's a real challenge. I mean, money is an important source of conflict in marriages and other relationships, for sure. So I think, you know, one thing that people can do is just at least try to agree at a high level on what their spending priorities and financial priorities are going to be. In particular, I think the one thing that sort of all couples should probably try to get on the same page about is debt. It turns out that debt is extremely toxic in the context of marriages. And so my biggest piece of advice to couples with, financial challenges or couples who tend to fight about money is to make debt the priority. Like, let's make sure that we're not in debt. And then everything else from there, you know, though the additional money conflicts that a couple might have are going to be fairly minor in comparison to the conflicts that arise in the face of debt.
Why is debt so upsetting? Is it because we sort of don't gain anything, but we're paying out every month or whatever it may be?
Exactly. Often we've already gotten the benefit, and now we're just paying for it, which tends to be painful. Also, anything that lies in the future tends to attract our emotions to a greater extent than anything that lies in the past. And because debt is something that sort of lies ahead of us that we always have to deal with, it's still there, it's still in the future, it tends to arouse our emotions to a greater extent in a very negative direction than many other kinds of financial issues.
Why do you think it's taken science this long to take this question on and to look at all the very counterintuitive ways that money affects our emotions?
You know, it is really surprising to me that this hasn't been a topic for researchers much in the past. You know, I think the focus has just always been on how can we get more money. I mean, there's so many books that help people figure out how to accumulate more wealth. And so, you know, I think it represents a real shift to say, okay, wait, let's stop thinking just about how we can use money to get more money and instead think about how can we use money to get more happiness? And, you know, in a way it makes sense that question is just getting asked now because happiness research itself has only become a really serious field of study in about the last 20 years.
How often in your daily life do you ask yourself that question about, will this purchase make me happier and how does it cause me to spend my time? Is it like not at the grocery store but at the furniture store, that sort of thing?
Exactly. So, I mean, I don't think if I'm like reaching to buy some rice for dinner, I don't stop and ask myself, does this make me happy? Although sometimes I do think, you know, do I want to buy vegetables that are slightly more expensive, but they're pre-chopped for me? Mm-hmm. Or do I want to spend my time chopping these vegetables? So, even with small decisions, it can come up. And it just becomes sort of a habit where I don't have to go through necessarily a long thought process. I just kind of automatically now will reach for the vegetables that are already chopped.
Elizabeth Dunn is Associate Professor of Psychology at the University of British Columbia. Her new book, written with co-author Michael Norton, is called Happy Money, The Science of Smarter Spending. Elizabeth, you've given us a lot to think about. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. We had production assistance from Lindsay Connect. Christine McConnell does the podcast, and our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. You can learn more about the show, find out about upcoming programs, and download the podcast free at kera.org/think. If you want to let us know something, a comment, question, suggestion, you can email it to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.